Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul.
And welcome to more of our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas, show number 180. And today we've got three great guests for you, including Tony Dunst, the guy you know from the Raw Deal segments on the World Poker Tour, who has cashed in four events here at the WSOP this summer. Also, Shannon Shore, who has five cashes this summer, including third place just a week ago in the $10,000 buy-in Six Max No Limit Hold'em World Championship. But we start off with a guy who was one of last year's November 9. He finished fifth at the WSOP main event for a cool $2.2 million payday. He's also had eight other cashes at the WSOP in the last 4 years. And earlier this year, in April, he took down the Heartland Poker Tour event at the Palms for another $71,000. Phil Collins, welcome back to The Final Table.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. I love the way they always put the word cool in front of a cash sometimes. I don't know. What is the qualification? I think anything over $1 million is always, yeah, that's pretty cool.
I think the second comma.
He didn't win, but that's a cool 2.2.
Excellent.
Well, we talked to you in between, when you had made it to the November 9, but we haven't talked to you since the November 9. So I do have to ask you about one question, which I'm sure you're actually sick of at this point, and that was the limping strategy at the final table. You were the only person who was doing it last year. In retrospect now that we're into 2012, when you look back on that, what do you think of how you played?
I'm completely fine and at peace with every decision I made at that final table. I've learned to live with making my decisions based off the information I have, and if I was incorrect but I like my logic, I'm usually just happy with it. And I don't have near as much money as $3 million in online winnings might lead your average person to believe, so I was still very, very nervous when playing a tournament like the main event, where you look at the money jumps and there are hundreds of thousands right off the bat, and the difference between ninth and sixth is $1 million. It's nerve-wracking trying to play poker at that level, and I decided that I wanted to reduce my variance and make my decisions as easy as possible. I was trying to play as straightforward, only get it in with premiums kind of poker, and I knew that if I was raising and folding marginal hands, they would quickly see it, they'd see my whole cards, and I felt like I was likely to be abused by some very good players on my left,
I love this.
Pius and Ben.
An honest poker player, because I don't care who you are, if you're sitting at that final table and you look at the difference between ninth and eighth and seventh and sixth, that's, life-changing money there.
Absolutely.
And by your play, you made another $1 million. Congratulations. Well done.
Hey, I know people who are doing that in small tournaments. They're looking up and going, well, it's another $60 to jump up here, or another $240 to jump up here, whatever it is. That money matters to them, and when you're talking about multiplying that by 100 or 1,000, as you were doing in your case, that's understandable. Were there hands when you went back and watched? Well, first of all, have you gone back and watched the coverage?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there hands when you went back and watched it? You said you were comfortable with all your decisions, where you thought to yourself, you know what? I limp folded there, and those are some chips I could have saved.
Right. A couple of hands that come to mind were, I think I open limped the first three I played, and then I decided to raise the fourth, because I have to have it now, right?
Right.
With A7 of diamonds under the gun, and Pius 3 bet me. And I was like, I knew it. Dang it. I'm not going to shove this hand. Fold. And he had King Jack, like I heard later. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Big surprise.
Yep.
It's frustrating. But at the same time, it just kind of made me say, I wish I would have just limped. He might have mucked the King Jack if I hadn't opened. So I set myself up for it. He saw straight through it. And little things like that irked me. But at the time, I was making the decision and happy with it. If one hand in particular, I limp re-raised Ace Queen. and Pease had raised with ace-king. And I really, really wanted to just fold. I wanted to limp fold so bad, but I thought I couldn't do it, and the main reason was because my whole cards were being exposed. Everyone would know, not on, like, I don't want to look stupid, but my opponents are going to know I'm limp folding ace-queen, like, yeah. I'm going to get run over. That dynamic, I thought it through. Like, the limping strategy is hard to exploit when you know someone's limping, and they're going to just shove all in if they have a good hand. I knew I was going to have a short stack, so...
You know, this is really interesting because we have not heard from people who were in that situation making a final table of the WSOP and having to deal with the stream and the feedback for the people around them. Were you getting feedback on what other people were doing from your friends? And,
right.
And did you see them getting information on you? And right there you said, I can't let them exploit this.
Yeah, it was something that I had to take into consideration that made playing with a 30-minute like stream 15-minute stream, whatever it was, difficult. Or it's a new form of poker. It's still poker. But, yeah, I was going over to my rail who were getting updates from people watching on television, and then I knew my opponents were as well, and that we had been addressed that issue from the WSOP staff, and we all knew it. It's not cheating. It
was there a time when you used that information against somebody later?
No, not really. Everyone there is a good poker player, and I know that just because they were bluffing in one spot, it doesn't really have any influence on the next hand. It's kind of, they have bluffs in their range, they have value hands in their range. I kind of know what they're going to lean towards. Just because I saw PU's 3-bet me with King-Jack the first time, my decision's still extremely difficult the next time. It doesn't really matter.
So is it a good thing, a bad thing, or just another level of poker?
I think it's just another level of poker, although I'd actually prefer if the players were sequestered. I think that keeps it at the purest form of poker. Whenever you muck your cards after a bluff, part of that is not them not knowing.
Yeah.
And part of calling is to get information, and that's taken away with the live stream. I love it, though, and I think that our sport, at least for the biggest event at the final table, should be streamed. I want to scream spade whenever my buddy's all in, and I want to feel like I rooted it on whenever it comes on the river.
Yep.
But maybe the players should be sequestered.
Yeah. Poker Stars on their main event at the PCA, which is the second biggest event besides the World Series, they sequestered them.
Yeah.
And they kept a wall up there. And if you went in there in the morning, you had to stay there. And they took away your iPad, they took away your phone, the whole bit like that. And if you left, for whatever reason, you weren't allowed back in. And it was a total sequester, but we were actually watching the final table in the players' lounge, you know, as it was going on. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, I watched that event. That was one of the first ones, I think, that was ever put on television, at least in America. It was right on ESPN, and it was incredible. And I knew it was kind of a groundbreaking moment for poker, and I was really hoping they'd start doing it in the main event. And coming up last year, me and my friends were, you know, fantasizing about what it'd be like if one of us got deep, because this time, if we're cheering, they're going to hear it. On TV, there's going to be a stream. They can't edit it out.
That's true.
That's right. So I started off by mentioning the cool paycheck that you got for coming in fifth. Has that changed the stakes that you're playing?
Somewhat. I've always been playing some of the biggest tournaments, so I'm going to continue to do that. But I guess whenever I play cash, I'm playing a little bit bigger. I'm not sure. I put a lot of it into savings, and I'm trying to be very wise about how I use it. So it's making the retirement plan look a little bit brighter.
Yeah.
Has that experience running deep changed your game or changed how people play against you so you have to change your game a little bit?
A little bit. I think that's a new dynamic that I'm learning to deal with right now, going through my first World Series after something like that. I kind of experienced it online as well, where I went from knowing that I was an amateur and that people would only have an experience with me at the table and I could build an image there, to knowing that everybody knows who I am, especially once you start playing a lot and once you play against the other stakes. You already have a built-in image when you're playing 100 rebuys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm starting to learn. I've known what that feels like before, to have people playing back at you that you've never played with before.
Yeah. And speaking of the fallout from doing so well and making it to the November 9, how many requests for funds have you gotten from the University of South Carolina Alumni Organization? I mean, you're USC Fildo online. You've got USC right there in your online name, so you're proud of your alma mater. They must be coming to you all the time. Hey, we could build a new lab if it were up to you.
I think they lost my number because I haven't had any. My brother actually gets complaints. He's like, I'm not going to donate to South Carolina. I'm donating $1,000 a month still to pay it off. Like, call me whenever I'm not doing that.
I love it.
I mentioned in the intro that you took down this Heartland Poker Tour event at the Palms. What made you decide to play that? Is there something about the structure? Is it the fact that they draw mostly amateurs?
I love playing. I've always played low stakes. Even whenever I was playing 1Ks, I would still play 10 rebuys. It's more fun than a 1K a lot of times. Whenever you get to build a big stack or just try new things. So that just because it was small didn't mean that I wouldn't play it. 71,000 is definitely not small.
No.
And my friend Dan O'Brien actually told me that they were going to have the tournament at maybe 3 or 4 days before. I didn't know. And he went, he played day 1B and got up to 100,000. And I played day 1C and I had 100,000 to shoot for and I beat him pretty bad. I got to 180.
Yeah.
I was feeling good. And so we were good buddies and we both made the final table. So it was cool to play with him. And
Here you got 61 different tournaments and a variety of new ones, this mixed match and some of the others.
I noticed the reentry, the 1500 right off the bat whenever I saw the schedule. And I thought, you want those reentries in your prize pool or multiple starting days. Like the tournament at Heartland Poker had 3 starting days, and that helps to get a bigger field. Some people can't always show up on a certain day.
We've asked this of a couple of other pros. And remember that the vast majority of our listeners are people who don't have big bankrolls. If they do come to the WSOP, they're going to come and, you know, try to make it here over a weekend. And if they want to play in a bracelet event, it's probably going to be $1,000 or $1,500 buy-in.
Right.
So when they look at a re-entry like that, is it better for them to play on day 1A, where you're going to have a field full of people who are deep enough in their bankroll that the 1500, if they blow it on a flush draw, okay, they'll just come back and play the next day, but that may mean more mines that they have to cross in the minefield? Or should that person, that weekend warrior we're talking about, look at 1B, because you're going to have a little bit less of that?
Yeah, I've wondered things like that before, but I think it's kind of irrelevant because it just comes down to your table draw. In a field full of bad players, you can get a good player on your left, and it can be enough to ruin what was a good field. So I think there's so much more variance in who's sitting on your left and who's at your table than which day drawn in thin air. You never know who's going to be there, and even on a...
The one thing I've noticed on those re-entries, when you get down to the last level, last two levels of the night, the people that are there that are just going to rebuy if they bust out don't want to leave with a short stack. And if they start with 4,500 and they're sitting there with 6,000 or 7,000 and the average is 12, their chips are going to be in there somewhere, you know. And they're looking, they're hoping for a 50-50. They'll settle for a 70-30 even, but they're hoping for a 50-50. So, you know, it's a way to build. I actually think if you play 1A, you're more likely to have a deep stack for the Monday than you are playing 1B.
I'll play both because I'm looking to chase bracelets, but I think it's definitely a great idea to, if you're going to satellite into a tournament, if you're going to play one, check out the reentry. The added equity that you get in the prize pool, it's the biggest, and besides, if you're going to win one, it might as well be the biggest one.
Yeah, what the heck? Why not?
Right? Why not?
It's,
yeah.
It's cool.
Phil, you've had one cash of the ones that I mentioned in the intro. One of them was in a stud event. Everything else has been hold'em. Are you sticking with hold'em, or this year are you going to try to play more mixed?
I'm playing a little bit of mixed games. The World Series, those buy-ins really, really add up, so I'm trying not to throw on more variants of 1,500 stud and Omaha 8 events because those add up as well. And I want a couple of off days because there's a no-limit event almost every other day.
Mm-hmm.
I have the 2,500 8 game penciled in, though. I actually think that I play all the games really well. I got a lot of practice over the last few years playing all of them, and especially I went down to Cabo to play Scoop, and I was playing 8-game cash games on the side, and I played every tournament. I feel really good about how I play them. I need a little bit more justification before I'm willing to start playing all of them, but that 8-game, we'll see.
Is there one of these that like a deuce of seven triple draw or a Raz or something that you just have fun playing. You just want to play it, even if you don't think you're that good at it.
Absolutely. That's what makes it so fun. Doing the same thing over and over gets monotonous, and when you're mixing it up with the other games, triple draw is a very fun game.
I love you know how to play. Triple draw.
When you learn how to bluff in other games, it's just like, all right. Or you make a big call. Early in a stud tournament, I called with ace, king, queen, jack, high. I was pegging him on big Broadway cards, and the way it kind of worked out, I was like, I can justify a call here. He's like, yeah, dude. No pair called on the river and stud.
I love it.
Those are the best moments. You know, I don't get those in the limit as much.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
But you know what I like in your answer when I asked you about playing the other stud events? You started talking about how, you know, it adds up, all these buy-ins. And what a couple of times there's been kind of a theme through your answers here today, which is, yeah, you had a $2 million win last November, and you picked up a lot of other cash online and in other events. But you're very conscious of your bankroll, and you're not going out there. And this is something, Dennis, you talked about.
I harp on it all the time.
I mean, when you got turned into a poker millionaire there suddenly with the November 9 yourself, and you've given advice to other guys about this, right?
Oh, it's so easy. If you turn into a touring pro and you start playing all the big ones and hotel bill and airfare and everything like that, I've said this before, you can spend between $500,000 and $800,000 in a year. In nothing but buy-ins and hotels and everything else. That money disappears. Remember, if you win $2 million, Uncle Sam gets a third of it to start with.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't last long. And I don't know how many people, you know it too, people that have won a big tournament or have cashed really deep, and right now they're trying to scrape together the money just to enter tournaments.
Right. I've done that before in the past with my online bankroll, and it's very frustrating.
Absolutely.
And, I feel like I went to poker graduate school for 3 years, and now I'm a real professional. I'm married. It's no excuses on mistakes when it comes to managing your
money. So in actuality, making the final table last year versus doing it 2 or 3 years ago may have been a good thing.
Absolutely. I think it could have gone to my head a lot worse or in the wrong way. And honestly, I think you kind of have to have the right mentality to perform your best. I don't think I was capable of making the final table a few years ago. Just feeling too hot and arrogant, you're going to do something stupid over 8 days.
Yes, but let's be honest. There's another factor. He's married now.
I had two people rooting for me.
See, there you go.
Two people rooting for you and two people keeping an eye on the bank account.
Yeah, that
there's
keeps
nothing
you
wrong
sober
with that either.
And keeps you playing your best. It's
absolutely
a very good thing. I think
absolutely
being a married poker player is a big edge
absolutely
for me.
As Phil Collins, the fifth-place finisher of the 2011 World Series of Poker, always happy to have another November Niner here sitting next to Dennis Phillips, a 2008 November Niner, and Paul Harris, probably not future November Niner. But this is our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas here on the final table. And up next, Tony Dunst, still the best-dressed man in poker. You know Tony for his Raw Deal segment on the World Poker Tour broadcast and also as the host of the live stream this past season of the WPT Final Tables. This summer, he has cashed 4 times of the WSOP, that in addition to 7 previous caches and 1 final table. Tony has also finished 2nd at the Australia-New Zealand Poker Tour main event, final tabled several events of the Aussie Millions, and cashed in the Asian Poker Tour. He's also remembered by our listeners as the guest who described Macau as an effing hole.
Yeah, that's Macau.
Tony, welcome back to the final table.
Well, thank you for having me back, guys. How's it going?
It's going very well. Congratulations on another full season and expanded responsibilities at WPT. How was it for you to do the live stream?
I really enjoyed it. Not only was it a new challenge in terms of commentary because we had to keep going for like 8 hours at a time, it was a great insight into how some of the top minds in the game are playing and gave me the chance to bounce all this strategy banter off of these other really talented poker players who were in the booth with me because we didn't have one set commentator with me. It was just a variety of people based on availability.
Who'd you have in there that really impressed you?
Let's see, I kind of recruited Dan O'Brien for it. At the start of the year, I just got to know him, and I thought, this guy can really talk, and he knows how to play, so let's get him in there, and he can alternate between call and action or just talking strategy and joking around. We had Olivier Bousquet in there, who is, of course, very bright, and everyone saw him on the World Series coverage last year and how articulate he is. Vanessa Selps came in the booth, and she is, of course, a very bright individual. And one other person that might be lesser known was a guy named Owais Ahmed, who came off of busting his final table and then straight into the booth, and he was just very thoughtful and objective about everything, and I thought displayed, you know, a lot of both maturity by being able to come off a frustrating bust without any, you know, hang-up about it at all, and versatility for just coming right in there and talking really well.
Yeah, we had Owais on and just a couple of months ago here on the show.
Did it, yeah, very,
very, very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you want there that you haven't had yet? Who do you think would be great sitting next to you in the booth?
Let's see. I'm not quite sure at this point. Like, I just keep getting guys as they fall into my lap, as it were, and sometimes my producers set it up. But it's usually about who's available, you know, deep in a tournament. I'm trying to think who else would be cool for something like that. I'd like to have my roommate Lucky Chewy in there sometime. I think he speaks about poker really well. I'm not sure if that's something that would necessarily interest him, but I think it would be really good, and he's a guy who's taught me so much about poker over the years and done so many strategy videos. I feel like he could probably work that somehow. Antonio Esfandiari, I thought his commentary during the World Series was excellent.
Absolutely.
And I think he's got a lot of personality. I like the guy, so I think it would be really fun to have him in there. Those are the two guys that really leap to mind, I would say, that I haven't worked with that I would like to.
Okay, to put you on the spot, is there somebody who you really don't want in there? You don't have to answer that. I'm sorry. That wasn't a fair question.
It would just be somebody who doesn't know how to keep banter going, somebody who is awkward or quiet or silent, and then they're just going to make your job really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
good.
You mentioned Lucky Chewy, Andrew Lichtenberger, mm-hmm. who's one of your roommates. We've talked before on this show here at the WSOP about the Vanessa Russo house, which has Maria Ho and Vanessa Selbst and Liv Boree in it.
Yes.
As possibly being the house with the most poker talent in it. You actually have more poker players in your house, I understand.
Yeah.
Give us a rundown on the talent that you've got lined up.
Okay. I'm taking my house over their house. Sorry, girls. I've got Lucky Chewy.
There's a prop bet. Ready to go here.
I've got Lucky Chewy. I've got Dan Smith, who has won everything under the sun in the last year. I've got Aaron Jones, who is A.E. Jones Online, who is a high-stakes cash rag for a long time. I've got Steve Silverman, who is Zugwad Online, again, very high-stakes reg online, played a lot of high-stakes tournaments in his day. I've got myself. I've got Timex, Mike McDonald, who is, you know, a huge talent at poker tournaments. Mike Watson, who's also had a really crushing year, won a big Bellagio Cup WPT back in the day, plays a fair amount of cash. So those are the seven in my household, and, I mean, it's a pretty good lineup.
I see a major problem here. You have the four of them over there.
Yeah.
Very talented. Nine.
Right.
You have to narrow yours down to four.
I mean, if I take the best four, I take Dan Smith, Timex. If we're talking just tournaments, I'll take Dan Smith, Timex, Lucky Chewy, and Mike Watson, I would think, and just straight up tournaments. I'd put those four against, and I put those four against almost any four you could come up with, you know, bordering on. I'm sure you could create a dream team of sorts, but as far as any household in Vegas goes, like, those guys are real just badasses. Yeah.
Now, tell us about life in a poker house for listeners who may just think, oh, I'm going to go out to Vegas for the series, and they're going to get a room at the Rio for the weekend or stay someplace else in town, and they don't understand what this life is like. Share with us some insight.
One quick question. Do you hire merry maids to come in?
You have to. That was the first thing I was going to say, which is if you're going to get a house with your poker-playing friends and you don't understand that house is going to get trashed, that nobody after a long day of poker is going to take any responsibility for cleaning it up or making it look presentable. So you need to have maids regularly scheduled to come in and make that place spotless.
Every day, maybe?
I mean, it depends. If you're planning on having people over that you need to make a quality impression on, then yes. if you're just going to try and live at a tolerable level throughout the course of the series, I would say once a week will be fine. Other stuff that you should know is that there's the possibility that there's a lot of noise when maybe you have to be up for a tournament, depending on who you're living with, or that there's drama of sorts. I happen to be in a household of guys who are mostly just about playing poker tournaments, not really going out, just want to get stuff done, and they get along real well. We've been doing this for years. But if you just come out with a batch of your friends the first time around, you should really give some consideration to how people's personalities are going to match up living together for 6 weeks and have some discussions as to what your priorities in a household are.
I'm thinking that if you had dark drapes on the windows in the bedrooms and Red Bull in the refrigerator, you got a good start.
You do have a good start, Dennis. That's absolutely right. You need those because you're going to be sleeping real late.
All right.
Can you ever find a really good poker player who's also a really good chef?
I think such a thing might exist, but the problem is during the World Series, he wouldn't have time to cook for you.
Or they're going to cook and say, what do you mean you were in a tournament? Yeah. I had it on the table at 7 o'clock.
That's the other thing. Yeah. And then you'll just break his heart.
Why do I think that conversation will never happen?
Never happen. Right. Back to WPT, Tony, you made a deep run in an event this year. Mm-hmm. Mike Sexton made a final table last year. Is there a rivalry?
With Mike? No, yeah. Not at all. I think Mike is great. Both Mike and Vince are beloved by the cast and crew on a level that I find quite unusual. Not unusual, but just like out of the ordinary, because often when somebody is put in the spotlight, it can get to them a little bit, or they have certain personality fractions with people, but those two guys, just everybody gives them a big thumbs up.
So if you were sitting across the felt from Mike, you wouldn't take his chips?
100% I would. I would cut your throat if you were sitting across the felt. That's how it works, man. You know the game we play.
I love it.
When Mike made the final table last year, did you get to do the play-by-play
that
time?
Yeah, I did his job with Vince. And then once this year I did the booth with Mike as well, mm-hmm. when Vince had to come out, and it's great with both of them. They're both really professional.
Are we seeing any changes to the Raw deal in season 11?
I don't think so. I think it's more or less the same, about the same duration and idea.
I had a listener who we tweeted mm-hmm. that you'd be on the show today, mm-hmm. and he emailed me the question. I'm trying to remember because I don't have it in front of me. But he said, since Tony does so much online stuff for WPT now, why doesn't he do more Raw deal stuff than just the one segment that we see each week on the TV show?
I don't know. I guess it's just the show already has a lot of segments, and they're trying to fit a lot of poker in there.
I guess he's thinking, why don't you do some Raw deal segments just for the website?
Oh, for the website.
Is that a time thing, maybe?
Partially a time thing. Those things really do take quite a bit of time to make, and partially an effort thing, just because there's only so many interesting hands from a final table, and then sometimes, honestly, I have to stretch it. Like, you know, sometimes final tables just don't get interesting hands. People get coolered, people lose flips, whatever. So then you're just, like, really reaching for material about something you know about a guy or some observation you're making. Sometimes we had final tables where there's such little material that we're like, okay, we're going to do a flashback Raw deal where you look at a final table hand from 2003, and it's like, how hard will this be to blow up about, you know? So that's the other thing, is there's only so many hands that are appropriate for a Raw deal, occurrences.
I had one particular tournament that I was going. I was doing the commentary for the final table, but I was playing in it ahead of it. And I think Robert Williamson, and so there were three of us down there, and whoever wasn't still in the tournament was mm-hmm. going to play it. Well, we got talking about it. How would this be? If you make a final table, and they mic you up so that you can commentate while you're playing it.
I mean, I made the final table in Jacksonville.
Yes.
And what they had me do was go from the final table straight into the booth and then ask, you know, the commentators what had gone on there. But if I were commentating right on the table, it would seem like, A, fairly awkward, and B, somewhat of an unfair disadvantage if I was allowed whole card access in order to make more accurate commentary.
Of course. I'll be happy to sit here if I can get a whole card.
For the most part, it just seems like, in the event I make a final table, they're going to get some other guys to do the online stream. Maybe I'll drop in after I busto, and I then do the Raw deal down the line about what the experience of playing at that table was like.
Speaking of talking at the table, there was some controversy at the WSOP here this year about when you get to the final table, you have to verbalize your actions rule, which I guess after the first week or so, there were enough complaints that the WSOP pulled back and said they were going to encourage you.
Yeah.
They won't penalize you if you don't. But at first, it was going to be, you can't just sit there silently. You've got to talk.
That's utterly ridiculous.
Why?
Because people acclimate to playing poker at a certain comfort level, and it's been done a certain way at the World Series for years. And you're talking about something that really changes the flow of the game, changes people's habits and routines at the table, and then if you're starting to penalize people for not doing something that they have essentially programmed their entire career against doing, it's just, I don't know, it seems really disrespectful to players. I understand, coming from the media side, that attempting to make watchable television or streams out of poker is difficult, and you need people at the table who show some personality or show some emotion. Otherwise, you're talking about probably a bunch of 24-year-old kids in sweatshirts doing math problems, silence. And you guys know what You guys know what I'm talking about.
That's exactly there, right. Seen that.
And I can understand why the World Series would attempt to implement something like that, but you can't force it. You cannot force people to do something that is so against what they've been doing for so long, and it's so opposite to what the rules have been here before, just because you're trying to get, what, slightly better ratings on your online stream? And it did not surprise me that everyone flipped the fuck out. And they really let them know on Twitter, you know, what they thought of that rule.
Yep.
And then the World Series Twitter let John Aguilar know what they thought of him.
Yes.
Yeah. And fortunately to about 70-some thousand people following the Twitter that they did that back to. That was not smart of either. So anyhow, we won't go there, though. No, I totally agree with you. Mm-hmm. That they took the Jamie Gould rule that was way over here to this side,
right,
and they swung it way over to the other side,
right,
and tried to make it. No, you can't do it. These guys are playing for hundreds of thousands of dollars. They don't want to try and change their game. They don't want to try and do something that could cost them.
Yeah.
But you know what I think the intention was? I don't think the intention was necessarily to get people to give things up.
No, not
verbally
at all.
Or that sort of thing. I think it was exactly what Tony said, 24-year-old
right,
kids in sweatshirts
in
doing
silence,
math problems silently. Yeah. That, I mean, that's the greatest description of a poker final table I've ever
heard.
I may use
that line a few more times.
Absolutely.
Okay. I love that line.
We're going to quote you
sure,
on that
go
forever.
Ahead.
But I think that when you have that, the problem is that even between hands, everybody's just sitting there silently.
Exactly.
Nobody even wants to talk. And I think what ESPN in particular, mm-hmm, and certainly Jack Effel, the tournament director, wanted to get going here for the stream and for the telecast,
right,
was, let's have some personality. Show the world that poker players can have fun and talk and banter at the table, which doesn't go on all that much.
It really doesn't. So I understand why they want it there, but I also think that, first of all, not only are you taking people out of your comfort levels, but second, if you attempt to force it, it doesn't really come off well. It doesn't actually come off interesting. It comes off hackneyed when people are being forced to make banter. And I think those moments that play well on TV have to develop organically. And as someone who's on the TV side of things now, I can say that sometimes you get lucky and you get a couple of characters on a final table who you know are going to act utterly ridiculous and blow up about things or take it all way too seriously or make wisecracks or whatever it is. And sometimes you get the final tables that I described where nobody there wants to do or say anything and they are just out for the win / the money. And even if they do win, they're going to be kind of relaxed about it. And that's obviously not what you're hoping for from a rating standpoint, but that's just the luck of the draw.
So we're going to have a new course on the WSOP Academy. It's going to be the Phil Hellmuth / Mike Manassal / Scotty Wynn / Daniel Negreanu School of Banter.
Okay.
How are you at the table? Do you talk a lot?
I wouldn't say that I talk a lot. I say that I'm willing to talk. If people speak to me, I'll speak back. And if one of my friends is on the table, I'll banter a little bit. If there's stuff going on in terms of like a sports game or something like that, you know, I'll be fairly chatty. Like I had a table last night where there was four people who were fairly friendly with each other. So there was a mild amount of banter during the course of play. And we actually used one guy's phone as a stream to set up the game because we didn't have a view of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that created a fun atmosphere. But there are plenty of other tables where it's pretty quiet and I'm pretty businesslike and I might even have my headphones in and just zone out. So, like I said, I don't really want to force any banter. And definitely after I've gotten this job, people are really over-anxious to make banter with me sometimes. So there are plenty of days where I just kind of want to sit and concentrate on what's happening in the game and what kind of decisions I should be making.
How is it for you?
Oh, I'll talk at the table. I didn't used to. I used to be very solemn, very silent, everything like that. Anymore, I'm going to have some fun at the table. I'm going to try and talk it up. I'm going to try and have some fun with people and find out what they do for a living.
You know what amazes me as a cash game player is I'll put in a 4, 5, 6-hour session, and I'll talk between – I never talk during a hand,
right,
but I'll talk between hands. You know, there's TVs on. There's,
sure.
You're ordering food. They're talking about, hey, are you going to the World Series? You know, all that sort of conversation goes
cash
on.
Cash is a lot of small talk.
Absolutely.
Small talk, yeah.
But there are always one or two players who sit there for 4, 5, 6 hours and never say a word.
Yes.
I don't know how they do that. I'd be bored out of my mind. I'm not talking about they're wearing headphones or anything. I know guys who sit there and do nothing but play poker, and they play ultra tight.
Yeah.
So that's the most boring thing in the world to me.
I would think so.
Yeah.
You won't find us doing that.
No.
Quick question for you. Mm-hmm. When you put the headphones on and everything, do you actually turn the sound up or do you put them on just so that nobody talks to you?
A little of both. A little of both. Sometimes I just have tables where I'm like, oh, my God, I just do not want to talk to anyone. I'm just putting these on, and please don't say anything to me.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah. I mentioned in the intro your success in Australia. The WSOP is going to Melbourne next year. Will you go?
I plan on going for the Aussie Millions in January. There's usually a lull in the WPT schedule there, and I love summer, and I love the Australian Open. That's the tournament I've been attending for the longest in my life, so it's got a sort of sentimental value, if you will, and I don't really care about getting a bracelet. You know, that doesn't really hold any more appeal to me than winning any other major tournament. To me, if you win a major tournament, you win a major tournament, sweet, doesn't really matter which place variants happen to befall you.
Yeah. You mean you don't play for you play for the money, not the bracelet?
Wait a minute. That's exactly right.
Because, you know, when the WSOP APAC in Melbourne was announced.
I think it's cool, though. I think it's cool that they're going there, and I highly recommend it. If they're like, hey, we were planning on having a tournament in Australia, I'd be like, you should do that.
But it surprised me that they were having it just a few weeks after the Aussie Millions, because...
Are you sure about that?
Yes. A lot of Americans who are going to the Aussie Millions are not going to take that 17-hour flight again to go back there just a
when
few weeks
scheduled?
Later.
When is it scheduled?
Could be wrong. I think the Aussie Million is scheduled for the last half of January.
Correct.
And I believe the WSOP is going to be the first week of March.
I think that's correct.
Interesting.
That's just too far to go
twice
in 2 months.
Yeah, they botched that. That's not going to work out well for them.
No, I think it's
I've taken that flight a lot, and I've become pretty comfortable with it, but most people hate it. Like, they just can't. They go crazy in a plane for that long.
Now, kind of as a side question for that, do you think the WSOP expanding first to Europe and now to Australia dilutes the number of people who come here to Las Vegas to play because they can win bracelets in their home country and they don't have to come here anymore?
I doubt it. I think that there's still the appeal of coming to the Mecca of poker for a little over a month of the year and gambling it up nonstop every day in a culture of people that do precisely that. And I think that's really the appeal to coming to the World Series. So I think that for the World Series to want to expand their brand / awareness to Europe and Australia is actually pretty natural. And I think that perhaps they or Harrah's is one day eyeing the possibility of an online poker room. I don't know that.
No, that's crazy talk.
You know.
How could that ever happen?
I would think anybody involved in this poker game might like a little piece of the online poker pie, and so having a larger degree of, so I'm told, of the online, of your brand's awareness globally is, of course, going to be very useful.
Yeah.
But the circuit event next year, from what I hear, is going to expand from 17 to 19. The WPT has been expanding.
Yes.
What's the saturation point? They're up to 61 bracelet events here. I mean, aren't we going to reach a saturation point after a while?
I think for the moment we have, because we are seeing all these events, WPT, the World Series thus far, down a bit. I can't prove that the World Series is down a bit, but I sense that it is. I think the numbers are down, and it looks like, you know, their first no limit event was a 1500, which got about 2K people. The first small no limit event last year was a 1K on like a Saturday. They got like 4K people. And the WPT has had events down in the United States this year. I think that within North America, you have reached that saturation point, and without an online market to pump players / money into this economy, it will start to shrink. And I think that's what a lot of us are observing. And I don't know where the saturation point is globally. I know that there are still some places and countries, particularly in Asia, where there's great potential, but you have bureaucratic issues and government issues. But within Europe, North America, I've got to think we're getting pretty close, and it's really going to just depend on how efficiently we can get money back into the poker economy.
I would add one thing. The buy-ins of 1K or more are having fewer people show up.
Yes.
But on the WPT side events and the WSOP circuit events and certainly on the Heartland Poker Tour, the $200, $300, $400, and even $500 events all had bigger turnouts this year.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is that there is still just as much interest in poker, but not just as much money in poker.
That may well be because I'm seeing a huge increase in the satellites and the mega satellites and everything. People are trying to qualify for these bigger events through some other way.
Right, instead of just having the straight-up cash to buy in like they had
in previous years.
Yeah. That's Tony Dunst joining us here at the final table on our continuing coverage of the 43rd Annual World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas. With Dennis Phillips, I am Paul Harris. And now on to our next guest, Shannon Shore, young guy who's racked up over $4 million in tournament winnings over the last 6 years, including 20 cashes and 3 final tables.
This summer, he's added five caches to that, including finishing third last week in the $10,000 buy-in No Limit Hold'em 6-Max Championship. Last time we talked to him, Shannon was not yet a college graduate, but he is now, and we're happy to welcome him back to the final table.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Last time I talked, I think you were about to wrap things up at the University of Alabama.
Yeah, I think last time we talked was probably 2010, and it was just finishing up in May then. So glad to have it over with and glad to be back in poker full-time. It's hard to believe it's already been 2 years I've been going back at it full-time.
Yeah, you got your degree in business management?
That's correct.
What are you doing with it?
It's not too practical right now. I've been playing poker. I haven't been working on too many other projects, really.
Quick question for you, because I had this. I had a player ask me this yesterday. He said, you start out, and it's so different. Everybody's used to the deep stacks now, whether they're at the Venetian or wherever, and they start with this massive amount and a huge number of big blinds. On a 1,500, you're starting with 4,500. How does your strategy change? How do you handle those first couple of levels?
Yeah, that's the kind of the interesting thing about poker tournaments, in my opinion, is that they require you to be so versatile. Like, you need to be able to play those smaller stack tournaments, you know, to make money, as well as be able to play the big deep ones. In the smaller ones, I generally go about it. I don't get too out of line. I usually try to, you know, I show up on time at noon and try to be there when the bad players are trying to give their chips away. I don't really try to, you know, mess with the good players. You know, not that I'm ever going to really avoid anyone, but, you know, I'm looking for somebody to make a big mistake, and I'm going to sit there around 4,500 and be between 4,100 and 4,800 and then try to find a double through.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. A guy said his strategy, I was talking to one of the other pros the other day, he said his strategy is to basically knit it a little bit to start with, but by the dinner break, he wants to be up to 10 to 12,000 minimum, because if you're not up there then, you're almost, if you're still at that 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 range, you're almost at a shove or fold type of a stack. And he says, I hate being there. So he tries to get a little riskier if he needs to be, but he wants to be at that 10 or 12 by the dinner break. Does that sound like a good strategy?
I've heard of people taking that kind of approach. I tend not to think of it so much that way. I just try to look for good spots, and you know, if I'm there, so be it. But if it doesn't develop, I'm not really going to force anything, I guess. But yeah, obviously you don't really want to come back from dinner with 10 big blinds, or at any point really have 10 big blinds. But
I want to go back to something you said, though, about being there at the beginning, because we all know pros, famous and not so famous, who don't show up on time for tournaments. They're not there at noon when a noon event starts. They come at 12:30, 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock. I mean, at the WSOP, you can register for a noon event until 4:40. That's four levels in. And at that point, what are the blinds? 100, 200, and they're just starting to put antes in?
Now, antes come in on, like, the fifth or sixth level.
So if you buy in at 4:40 at the end of level 4, you come in at level 5, you're at 100, 200, and you start with a starting stack of 4,500.
Yep.
Now you're playing really short stack poker. So you don't think that's a good strategy to even be an hour late?
I never really could understand why guys do that in the shorter buy-ins. Sometimes, obviously, things come up and you got stuff going on and you can't make it on time. But in the WPTs and stuff, I can understand it, because you have just so many chips where the first couple of levels are almost meaningless. But in the shorter ones, yeah, I think you get there when all the amateur players who are in town are, you know, everybody's seated and people are ready to give their money away.
All those people who said, okay, I can afford to buy into one 1,500. I'm going to Vegas for the weekend. I'm going to play in that one 1,500 this weekend, and I'm going to try to do my best. That's the guy you want at the table with you.
Exactly right.
And again, when I was talking to some of the guys here from the WSOP, they said the average player here plays in about 1.6 tournaments is it.
Wow.
Which shocks the heck out of me when they said, really? I said, yeah, absolutely. If you have a field of 2,000, you might have 200 pros there that are playing a whole lot of them, and you might have 1,800 that this is the only tournament they're playing in.
Mm-hmm.
I did not realize there's that huge a percentage, but it's less than two tournaments during the whole 61 that take place here.
That's a really interesting statistic. Yeah, I'm surprised by that.
Yeah, I was very surprised too, and it just it validates your point that there's going to be a whole lot of people that are not used to playing this kind of level, or not used to being in this atmosphere with 2,000 people against them, and it's great to be there that first level.
Right.
Big difference between 4,500 starting chips and 15,000 or something that a lot of them are doing now.
Yeah.
On those, if you miss the first couple of levels, let's see, I only come in with 80 big blinds. Wow, you know, versus this one where you come in with maybe 20 big blinds. Big difference.
Yeah. What was your first WSOP experience?
My first World Series experience was in 06. I still remember it like it was yesterday. Hard to believe that was 6 years ago. I came out here with nine other guys, and we rented this probably four-bedroom house. We were all probably 21, 22.
All right, let me just stop right there and say, that was your first mistake.
Yes.
10 guys in a house. Oh, my goodness. And you're all 21?
Yeah, I guess the culture of this business kind of lends itself to that kind of craziness sometimes. But that was one heck of an experience. You know, I won't be doing that again, but it was great. I still am in touch with a lot of those guys and still live now with three or so of them. So
you came here, you all stayed in the same house, and when you come, was the Rio in 06? Or was it
yes.
still downtown?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Maybe it was the first year here. So tell us what your experience was coming to the Rio to play.
It was a lot of fun. I was just sort of getting my tournament poker career going. I started off really rough. I think I opened up like 0-14 that summer. Mm. So that was hard, you know. And you get humbled really quick out here. And
this is not the series to run bad in,
right?
Yeah, because it can really nail you quickly. So, how do you get over? That's a very good question, actually, because I keep a lot of times people ask me that. If you run into a bad streak where it seems like that every time you get kings, somebody has aces. Every time you have top set, somebody gets the flush. You know, the usual stuff. How do you handle those variances? How do you keep mentally tough?
It is extremely difficult. I don't think poker tournaments are for the weak of heart at all. Obviously, the sample size is what only us true like poker insiders understand about how, you know, 20 tournaments is really nothing.
Right.
And, you know, a family member or a friend, you haven't cashed in 20 tournaments, they think that's crazy. But, I mean, that's right. Completely standard.
Yeah.
So it's tough. I think you have to keep the variance in perspective. Recently, I've gotten into, like, fitness and stuff, where for the longest time I sort of, like, didn't treat my body too well. So I'm glad I got into that, and that helps me sort of maintain a balance.
I think he's lost as much weight as you did, Dennis.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Dennis, you look great.
Yeah, well, I couldn't look much worse than I did before.
Tell our audience what you did. You went from...
I've weighed as much as 237. I weighed about 174 this morning, and I'd been hanging around 200 the last
That'd be
last
63 pounds. A quarter of his body is gone. He is slim and svelte.
Well, I'm not quite that much, but I'm over 50 pounds that I've lost.
Well done. So, congrats.
Well, congratulations to you. And that's again, another point that we've brought to our listeners before, is you have to be physically ready to do this as well as mentally. I mean, just little things, being out here a day ahead of time, watching what you eat, making sure you keep hydrated, you know, just little things like that, well-rested, everything. You know, you don't come out here with nine friends and go into a party community called a house and have fun. It's not a good way to play poker out here.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to earlier. When you have all those friends and you know that there's going to be a party and then you're all going to go out drinking that night and maybe go to the strip clubs and go to nightclubs and all that sort of stuff.
Well, now, of course, we know you didn't do
any of that. Never. Shannon never, would right. never. Never, ever do that.
Yeah, no 21-year-old would ever do
no,
that in Vegas.
No, of course. That's crazy talk. I know. But how much is being in shape a factor in playing tournament marathons for you?
I think it's pretty big, honestly, and I didn't really realize it until recently. I think the clarity that it, just like the like the clarity of my mind and in my decision, it gives me much more focus. And even though the results haven't shown it lately, because as I said, I've been on a bad streak, I feel more in the zone playing poker tournaments now than I ever have. So I don't know. There's a lot of talk about it, like how much is the, you know, people have different opinions on it. But I personally know I come to work each day feeling much better now than I did, you know, a year or 2 years ago.
I agree with that. What it is right now is there's such a high quality of players at these tournaments now. It's not like it was 5, 6, 7 years ago, where you always know when you sat down at the table, this is somebody's first tournament or whatever, and there were people you could, you know, aim at, shall we say. There's anything you can do to give yourself a little bit of an edge, a little sharper mind, a little better rested, you know, your back isn't bothering you. I don't know. You name it. Anything that gives you a little bit of an edge, you need to take. And being physically fit and mentally ready is huge.
I agree. Yeah, and the reality of it is, in one summer, one decision is very likely going to, you know, well, Matt, it makes or breaks your whole summer. So if you're not ready to make a big decision at any point this whole summer, then, you know, you're going to be giving something away.
Absolutely. Every tournament that you play, unless you just ran like God or something, comes down to one or two, or at the most probably three different hands where you had to make a decision.
Yep.
And if you make the right one, you're sitting at a final table. If you make the wrong one, you're watching a final table. It's just that simple many times.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Shannon, you qualified for the Epic Poker League last year. I don't know whether you played in there or not, but can you tell us about your thoughts on Epic?
Yeah, Epic was a great experience. Obviously, I was honored to be selected. I did play all three Epics that ran and busted all three of the 20,000 buy-ins. But I did enjoy the experience. I would love to see it work out. I haven't been following the story too closely, what's been developing, if anything. Obviously, it's tough for a lot of those guys who cashed and had some equity or equity in the free roll. But sort of the way I feel about this business is I'm just ready for anything. You know, we decided to do this. So, I mean, that kind of stuff happens. It was a business decision. And, you know, stuff's going to go wrong in any business. So I don't think you can feel, you know, too bad about it.
So the idea they had, you like, having almost like a PGA-type quality higher level where it's just the elites that are playing in it and competing against each other. You like that idea?
Yeah, I did. I think people like that type of stuff just in general, just rankings and, you know, set stops and, you know, mm-hmm. just like PBA or PGA or whatever it is, tennis.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's something really kind of cool about that. And, you know, that'd be fun if something like that could get going again.
Okay. Now, speaking of pros in those other sports, most of them have sponsors who are helping to pay for their equipment and their travel and their hotel and all the rest. In poker, sponsorships have gone by the wayside because of Black Friday last year.
Right.
How hard is it to be a touring pro in this environment?
It is extremely difficult. That's not just saying that being results-oriented. I know, you know, I've lived this for a long time, I guess, and if you don't, playing the poker is only half the battle. It's things like managing your expenses are extreme. You know, you look at a lot of the guys on the tour and stuff that just walk around. They don't really know what they're doing. But you better be straight with your records, have all the taxes and stuff together. And
this is where the business management degree comes in.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
This is your business, and you got to manage it.
Right. That's another reality. That's what we're doing. We're running a business. So.
Yeah.
Well, again, to bring kind of perspective in here to the listeners, I don't think you realize that during the course of a year, the volume of money that you can burn through in playing these tournaments. If you're playing the high caliber ones, and I'm not talking about, you know, some $100,000 buy-in or even the 25s. If you're just playing tens and lower, but you're playing consistently, you're doing this for a living. With that and the expenses from travel and hotels and food and everything else, you can burn it through anywhere from $500,000 to $800,000 in a year easily.
Wow.
Easily. And that's not, you know, doing these megas and huges. That's not going to Australia to play the $250,000 buy-in. That's none of that stuff. I'm just talking about being a touring pro and playing in the major tournaments around the country.
So does that mean that you have to win one event a year? Do you have to make several final tables a year?
You're gonna need to. Obviously, the variance of these things is huge. Yeah, those buy-ins, they do just stack up. You know, you blink and you've been through 100K in buy-ins. So yeah, you better find some deep runs, or you're gonna be on the. You know, yeah. It's gonna hurt a little bit.
And we've had we've had Alan Kessler sitting in here and talk about how he gets free lunches at the M. You know, to help his and who was it that was touring Europe and was talking about he tries to see how little he can spend while he's traveling around there. We had one of the pros here doing that.
Yeah,
but I think as you get involved, and you've now been doing it for several years, you find the little corners to cut, you find the people you can share a hotel room, you find the ways that you can take advantage of this, all the way down to and even including the award points that Harrah's gives you and being able to go eat a free meal somewhere.
Yep.
It adds up. It adds up a lot.
Yeah, I think it's easy in doing what we do to get caught up in, just, you know, you're throwing like 10,000 buying here, so what's like 1,000 in a night going out in nightlife?
Yeah.
But you're playing for a much smaller, you're pushing that much, or you're putting that much money at stake, but your edge obviously is much smaller. So,
right.
You know, just because you pay 10,000 for a tournament doesn't mean you go spend, you know, 1,000.
EV in the nightclub, higher or lower?
it's called maturity.
So you started out as an online player when you were in college, and, of course, for 13 months now.
Wow, you were 21 when you were in college?
Yeah.
Never mind. Go on.
He's 46 now. No, he's actually about to turn 27, like any
Correct.
Like next week
next
or something.
Next week, yeah.
All right.
So you started out playing as an online player. Are you itching to get back to that? And if so, are you considering moving to Canada or Costa Rica or somewhere?
You know, I really enjoyed my time playing online poker, getting started, of course, which propelled my career, and then playing along the way to kind of supplement income. And I always enjoyed online poker. And, yeah, so I should have taken a little more initiative in the last year or so getting up there to set up, but I will get set up in the next couple of months because I intend on being in Europe a bunch in the fall so that way I can play while I'm there.
You feel the itch to have online as part of your life again, or is it, again, part of the business management part? You have to do that to supplement what you do live.
You have to. You know, I need to be working, so there's it's either doing that or traveling to these live tournaments. So, you know, it's nice to spread it out over, you know, online you can spread it out over, you know, 50 tournaments and what would take you, you know, a month or two to play, live.
Well, now, again, the variance is can be huge on the live tournaments especially. You get online, less variance because you're playing so high of a volume of tournaments there. But isn't the caliber of play online also creeping up there? Isn't it getting much, much harder to run deep in these tournaments?
It was until Black Friday, which I was playing up until Black Friday, and yeah, people were, you know, the games were not what they once were, that's for sure.
So how do you change your game then to counter that? What, you know, new moves, new steps, new
strategy? You just have to, in tournament poker, it does evolve so much, I feel like, so you better be ready to adapt. It's just, you know, and you better be observing what people are doing and taking notes and...
So do you get involved in the chat rooms and the discussions there? Do you have a group of friends you confer with? Do you have books you read or people you listen to? Or how do you stay on top of it?
I'm somewhat active on 2+2, and I have good friends that, you know, we talk amongst ourselves. I don't talk hands and stuff. I've always never really liked the idea of giving too much away. So I'll talk with my close friends, and we'll make decisions on stuff. Maybe we should get a few more opinions, but that's how we've been going about it, just staying fresh, you know, talking amongst each other.
Speaking of giving too much away, I saw you quoted as saying that one of your pet peeves when you're at the table is players discussing strategy at the table. Why don't you like that?
Yeah, that's another thing I never understood. It doesn't really make much sense. You know, we're trying to, take other people's money. That's just
well, that's the nature of the game.
The way it is. So to educate anyone, or when someone makes a bad play, to, you know, berate them and tell them how the guy paid his admission, he can play however he wants, you know, as long as it's within the rules. So
what do you do? This happens a lot in cash games, which I tend to play 95% of my poker life is in cash games. I've been in games, particularly smaller games, PLO particularly, people who are new to the game, they come, they sit down at the table, they make a play, whether they win or lose the hand is immaterial, but then they'll turn to me, having shown me their cards, and say, did I do the right thing? And I always feel like I'm in an awkward situation there where, you know, if they won the hand, I want to tell them they did the right thing because I want to encourage whatever it was they did, even if it was wrong.
Right.
If they lost the hand, what do you do when you're in that situation?
Yeah, that's never fun. whatever anybody does.
Do you run into that in tournaments too?
Yeah, every now and then. I don't know. You just kind of go along with it, I think. There's something to be said about just being honest with people.
Yeah.
So
would you tell somebody, well, it was obvious that guy was on a flush draw, and when he hit it, I can't believe you called. I mean, would you ever say something like that?
I might break it to him gently that, you know, he probably should have let the hand go.
What do you do, Dennis? This probably happens to you way more than it does to us because you're so recognizable. People sit down next to you. They know you're the friendly guy, and I bet people show you their hands and ask for your advice all the time. What do you do?
At almost every tournament, and it is an awkward situation, especially if some guy made a, and I'm going to be polite, questionable play there.
Okay.
You don't want to berate him. You don't want to say, are you an idiot or something like that. So you try to answer it truthfully. You have to be honest with him. You maybe give him a little bit of a tip or something. But I'm not there to educate the guy that's playing against me.
Yeah.
I really, you know, we're in a tournament. We're in a cash game. We're playing this for the chips. I want the chips in front of me. What I hate is when somebody sits down to you and they lean over and says, how do you play suited connectors? You know, wow, how do you answer a question like that? There's only 50,000 different ways to do it, that type of
deal. Well, the correct answer is always, it depends.
Yeah, you know, they ask these generic questions and expect you to come up with this, you know, mind-boggling Einstein-type answer, and there is none.
Yeah.
You know.
But Shannon, you said you don't even go back and discuss hands with your friends. Aren't there times where you're in a tournament and you can describe the situation because it's so vivid and you might, maybe it was not necessarily the tournament, the hand that knocked you out of a tournament, but one that may have crippled you early on or one that confused you as you were playing it. Don't you go back to other people and say, let me tell you about this hand and let me see what you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I do that with my close friends, three or four or five guys. But other than that, you know, I just don't – I've never liked the idea of giving too much away, like I said.
Yeah.
So I try to keep all of my poker, like, you know, everything I think about how poker should be played, you know, within my close group of friends.
Yeah.
And I will have to admit, I've had times where people have sat down and then they'll start talking about some hand we talked about here. Oh, I'll bet you had, you know, they'll try to analyze how I'm playing now versus what the hands I've played or, you know, well, I know you, I've seen you limp with aces under the gun and, you know, whatever the heck type stuff.
Yeah. And I heard on your show that you did this with Jack 8 once.
Yeah.
So that's what you probably had in that hand against me, right?
Yeah. What was it, the 2-5 I talked about that one time? Oh, my gosh, I was so bad.
Yeah.
I ended up with the nuts with a 2-5 after I'd bluffed pre-flop, flop, and turn. And then I caught the magical card on the river and took
the
guy's
wheel.
Entire stack.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was not happy with it. And I don't blame him. I'd have been mad at myself if I'd have been playing against me. One last question. Did you do any multi-tournament? Mike Sexton did that immediately, and he's cashed in two tournaments already of the first three. He's running back and forth between tables. Did you have to do that last year, or is that something you would do?
I did do that a couple times last year. I think there was a Raz tournament or something where I was, you know, crippled coming into day two, and so I also played like a no limit hold'em that started at noon that day, and then just ran over to the Raz, which you know, you don't like to do that, but sometimes.
Explain for our listeners who have not been to the Rio to see this going on the dynamics of that, because people multi-table online all the time. All they have to do is switch screens, or in many cases, it's on the same screen, and they're just moving the cursor back and forth. Here, you got to move your body back and forth, and sometimes between rooms, because, you know, one may be starting in the Brasilia room, and the other one's being played in the Pavilion or the Amazon room. How do you do that? How do you determine when you're going to jump up and go? You can't just do it on breaks.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The times I did it, I vividly remember, like, sprinting through the hallways. Trying to catch as much action as you can. Obviously, on your 20-minute break from one event, you'll go play the other.
Yep.
And the dinner break or whatever, you'd play the other. So it's pretty interesting. And then, you know, in the no limit, if you, you know, run up a huge stack or something, maybe you leave that stack and go play the other event.
But do you
just depending on the time, like, where each event is, basically.
And do you look at what your position is at the table if you want to go and run and play a few hands at one? It's not a break, but, okay, well, the blinds are coming up. I'm probably not going to play those because I'm not going to play much out of position. I'm going to run now. I mean, does that come into play as you?
Not particularly, because if I'm going to the other room or something, I'm probably going to be there for, like, a half hour, so I know I'm going to miss an orbit.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually remember being in the Pavilion room, I think it was, and Ivy comes running in there, and they had moved him from that table while he wasn't playing into the Amazon room, so he's running around to a floor. Where do I go? Where do I go?
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to our guests, Shannon Shore, Tony Dunst, and Phil Collins, for joining us at the Rio in Las Vegas as part of our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker. And thanks to you for downloading the show via FinalTableShow.com or iTunes or Stitcher Radio. For Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. We'll see you next week with another edition of the Final Table Poker Radio Show.